Okay. Well, welcome to the second session of the course with the Mises Academy on the totalitarians. That's that can be seen with the slides slideshow we've got going on here. This is the Mises Academy. We got a good start last week talking about some of the very deep history, deep chronologically, that some of the deep history behind totalitarianism, and we sort of made it up to the, in a general sense, to the 19th century. But, of course, Mises, in his great work, Omnipotent Government, really is most concerned to deal with totalitarians in the form of German totalitarians. And he goes back, interestingly, to the 19th century history, in particular of Prussia, so that that he puts it all in a context. And that's what we want to look at pretty carefully today, to explore that history a little bit. There's a great quotation that Mises gives us, and we've got a slide devoted to it, but it is one of my favorites. Historical knowledge is indispensable for those who want to build a better world, and that's in our reading for today. And that really resonates for me, and I'm sure it does for you too. So what I'd like to do is to delve into the historical part and also into the theoretical part in these first sections, the introduction in part one and part two of Omnipotent Government, and see if we can't work our way through it. It is a wonderful and profound and complex piece of writing. It's a piece of writing that is at once theoretically very careful and also written in the moment of the crisis of the 20th century. So it's a famous book that evokes a lot about the time and the place and the man himself, Ludwig von Mises. And so it's really an exciting thing for me to get to go through this this book with you. It's a book I read, who knows how long ago, 30, 35 years ago for the first time. And I did notice as I picked up my copy of it, I had also stuck some of my notes on the book from, I guess, a reading from around 1980 or something. And so that's been fun for me too, to look at these notes and kind of think about the book as I've gone back over it. So without further ado, let's plunge in. Let me just do one administrative thing. The assignments for the reading for this week, in other words, that it's all written out on the Moodle site. And so if you are taking it for a grade, please do let me know. And you can communicate through Moodle or communicate through email. Either way is perfectly fine. I'll keep track of it. And if you'll let me know that you want to take it for a grade, then I can set up a kind of grade book for you, and I'll keep track of the assignments you send in. It's not a very complex assignment. It's a page of writing about the readings, and so you can look at the instructions on Moodle and do that if you like. But do get in contact with me if you would, one way or the other, and let me know what that you want to take it for a grade, if you want to take it for a grade. So that's the administrative part, and let's proceed. The way I want to work today is to go through the theoretical and historical background, which is, of course, essentially what this part of the book is all about. We want to talk about German and some other continental liberalism. We want to talk about militarism and the role that Mises saw this playing in the destruction of German, or the collapse of German liberalism, not the destruction of it. We want to talk in some detail about what he calls Ekatism, which is a term that, of all the Misesian terms, has probably caught on the least, but we'll talk about that. And then we need to talk in very careful detail about nationalism and about Mises's understanding of it and his excellent sort of sociology of nationalism and the history of nationalism. So that's where we're going, and you see the two autocrats up at the top on the right hand, Ludendorff, a World War I autocrat, the other guy, I'm not really sure. So let's move on and go to the next slide. Hey, here's what I've done for this lecture. I thought to myself, you know, for periods when we're going to be talking just a little bit about concepts and so forth, why not make use of this thing that's become a parlor game, but to start really out as a kind of linguistic exercise in texts, the word cloud. And so I've made several word clouds. I don't know if this is hokey or not. I think I see something in these things, but maybe you don't. In any case, it's better than just hanging on a slide that you know, that has some bullet points on it while we talk in detail. This is actually a word cloud of the introduction. In other words, I just took the introduction, fed it into a word cloud maker online, and this is what came out. So obviously the German and the government and the economic aspects are there. I think this introduction is quite a wonderful piece of writing. And what I hope to do at the end, having reread it again for this week, what I hope to do at the end is have us all reread the introduction at the end of the course, maybe for the last session, because it is so rich that there's no real way that we could do it justice on just one reading. So maybe we'll do that again. Some of the important themes in Omnipotent Government, I've thrown down on this slide, and here's the as I mentioned earlier, just before we started recording, when we were all gathering forces, what I would like to do today is to go through the book, to talk about the history that he discusses, to clarify the concepts that he brings up, to clarify some of his ideas or investigate some of his ideas, all of this from my standpoint. Then in the second half of today's class, we will go completely question and answer, so it will be from your standpoint that we deal with things. So let me talk about some important themes that he introduces in this intro and that are pervasive in the book. I mean, the central point here is that the main problem is collectivism, and I think this is the insight that puts Mises in a different place from many other commentators. Somebody mentioned Hannah Arendt last week, and this is what makes him different. This is what makes him different from Franz Neumann and other analysts of the problem of totalitarianism. And in this sense, and it's kind of giving away the punchline to this course in the very first point of the very first time we delve into the book, but it's important enough that I think we can give away that punchline and work on it throughout the course, and that is that that totalitarianism is, in a sense, just simply a part of a continuum, and that all of the interventionist policies, all of the étatist schemes lead in some measure or at some speed or in some way to the same end. So the main problem in the view of Mises is that the total regimes are in some way completely different from other étatist regimes, but rather that they are in essentials very similar. So that's one important insight. Secondly, in a world of property rights and freedom, no war. He wrote the book in the dark days of World War II. He wrote the first version of this book, which was in German, called, if I'm correct, In Namen des Staates, that's in the name of the state. And that was in 1938, so that was the kind of draft was 38, and then in the mid or early 40s he wrote the book. And there he says, okay, well, let's look at all this warfare that's going on and think about how he looked into the issues of, well, what? Of naval warfare, of rationing, of bombing, of terror killings on all sides by all participants in all ways. And he looks through and he says, well, the main problem here is that it's collectivism. In a world of property rights, properly protected, properly respected, there'd be freedom, there'd be no war. And so this, too, is a theme that he follows up throughout the book. So a third and related, almost a necessary point to know for the first two, is that Mises views the last 200 or 300 years as having seen writing from the standpoint of his time. Now it would be more. But I see a question from someone, which book are you referring to? Well, it's Omnipotent Government. All throughout these slides, OG means omnipotent government. That's that's really the core of this whole course. So and that was the reading for today and everything. So a central problem of modern history is the struggle between collectivism and individualism. In other words, Mises sees this power and liberty as having knocked heads throughout the whole history of the modern period. And that's an important element. Of course, what he's saying is that in the 20th century, they're just overwhelming things, that civilization is being overwhelmed with these, with the statist or etatist philosophies and processes and regimes. But again, interventionism, in his view, leads to the same problems as totalitarianism, just with a little bit different complexion to it. And finally, then, that quotation, I mentioned it once, I'll mention it twice, and we will mention it again. Historical knowledge is indispensable for those who want to build a better world. And that's a real theme of the book, that if you just forget about the history of our world, if you say, well, that was back 150, 200 years ago, not much relevant to me and my computer today. Well, he's saying it is relevant, and you have to know this, or you will get into trouble. So let's turn to the history of the thing and just plunge right in. Now, I'm a historian of modern Germany, and that's my primary scholarly research area. It's been the area I've published the most in terms of my historical writing, and the Prussians are a big important part of modern German history. And what I'd like to talk about now is the view that Mises gives us of the Prussians, and I want to put those into context within the German world. So what we do, that, by the way, is the Prussian eagle, the crest of the House of Hohenzollern. That's the dynasty that led the Prussian state, and I'll talk a lot more about them as we go. So here's a crash course, 5 minutes max, on the German world since Charlemagne, and some other stuff. So Charlemagne, well, that was Christmas Day 800, okay? So that's a while back. He was crowned the Roman Emperor by the Pope on Christmas Day 800. There's a complex story behind that. But let me just say this. He set up something that they called the Roman Empire. It included what's today France and Germany. And this empire was very backward compared to the real Roman Empire. Was very backward compared to the contemporary Byzantine Empire, which was also a remnant of the Roman Empire. So by any standards, this was a kind of backwards event. But But it was an empire. He did introduce Latin as the language of administration and a school for his bureaucrats. And I mean, it was such a limited thing that he couldn't even stay in his capital all year round because all of his bureaucrats and retainers would eat everybody out of house and home. And so they moved around to different capitals within within his lands, not within all Germany. But in any case, not within all Germany or France or the Low Countries or anywhere else. So this covered modern-day France and Belgium and Luxembourg and all of Germany and part of the northern part of Italy, actually. So it's a huge, big empire, and his grandsons had a falling out. This is part of the five-minute crash course. Grandsons had a falling out, and one thing led to another. The empire got divided, and the eastern part of it, the eastern part of the Holy Roman of the Roman Empire, Charlemagne, came to be called the Holy Roman Empire. One of his grandsons took charge there and became the first Holy Roman Emperor in those lands, and that was 962. So there's a a good bit of time elapses there. The grandsons actually had the civil war in 840s and settled that and so forth, and then one of their descendants was on the throne, so it's not the actual grandson in 962. That would be a pretty old grandson. But in any case, that's how the thing divided up, and you can look that up on Wikipedia and find out all the details if you like. But this Holy Roman Empire was a political entity. This is really important. Political entity that lasted until it was broken up by Napoleon and his defeat of Austria and Prussia. That was in 1806, and so the Holy Roman Empire existed till then, a very long-standing entity. For the last several hundred years of its existence, the Holy Roman Empire was ruled by the Habsburgs. You've heard of the House of Habsburg, and this was the house that ruled the Holy Roman Emperor from their capital in Vienna. The empire was not really an empire. Voltaire is famous for having said that it's neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. And this was kind of a smart-aleck statement on Voltaire's part, but it had a lot of truth to it. Certainly it was aligned with the church and the Roman church in many ways, and so it was holy, so to speak. They weren't Romans in it, but they wanted to kind of harken back to the great Roman Empire. And the odd thing is, the thing it was mostly not was an empire. The Holy Roman Empire was actually a confederation of independent states, especially toward the last few hundred years of it. By the time we get to the 1700s, for example, there were nearly 2,000 sovereign units within the Holy Roman Empire, all bound together in a confederacy, not even a federation, not even a some kind of loose. It was a very loose confederal group of states, and some of the states were pretty big and powerful, big duchies and margravates and whatnot, prince bishoprics, and then some were just tiny little landholdings. There was a class of folks called imperial knights. Those were individual noble families who owned their land as sovereigns. The only person that they had fealty to was the Holy Roman Emperor. So it's a clunky kind of thing. You know, the emperorship wasn't even passed along through father to son or by any sort of inheritance. Every time an emperor died, a new one was voted in by the seven and later eight leading monarchs within the Holy Roman Empire. So that's a weird curiosity, too. Everything within the Holy Roman Empire was negotiated and mediated, and it was just a place where if you were an Enlightenment person who, say, in the 1700s, insisted on things being equal and full of equilibrium and full of all symmetrical and all that. Well, it was not the kind of place that you would be bragging. In modern times, historians have had a lot more admiration for it, especially since we live in a world where the nation state has been so abysmal on so many levels. So the Holy Roman Empire is a confederation. Now, it included the lands of Austria, the lands of Prussia, the lands of Saxony, the lands of Baden, the lands of Bavaria. Each of these areas, each of these little regional states, you might call them, or countries, had its own ruling house and its own customs, its own army, its own sovereignty. And they periodically had meetings that were empire-wide, but it's a very, very loose confederation, right? Well, one thing the Reformation, oh, and there's the double-headed eagle that symbolized the Holy Roman Empire, the imperial empire there. Reformation, whatever else the Reformation was, it was in part a way for German princes within the Holy Roman Empire to get away from the Habsburgs. The Habsburgs were identified very closely with the Roman Church, and Martin Luther offered, among other things, among theology and all kinds of things, he offered monarchs like the Duke of Saxony the chance to get control of their church and become more sovereign. And so for the German world, the Protestant Reformation, which began in 1517, 1518, that Reformation meant that the countries became more independent, more sovereign. That the Confederation became even, well, it was in a way looser and not very very effective. The 30 Years' War kind of put paid to it in some sense. There still was a Holy Roman Empire after the 30 Years' War, but we associate the peace that ended the 30 Years' War, the Peace of Westphalia, with the breakdown of this system that had lasted for so long, this kind of mediated system, because what emerged was a really powerful set of German states, some medium-sized German states that didn't have much influence, and then kind of helpless other members in the Holy Roman Empire. So it's an interesting state form, and the winners that come out of it in the 18th century are Austria in the south and Prussia in the north, with a few rising stars or medium-sized stars, Hanover and Saxony and the Rhine Palatinate and some other places. But you get these two big powers that gradually emerge in the 18th century, Austria and Prussia. Now, within the Holy Roman Empire, the Margraves of Brandenburg, as they were called, were important princes, but they got more important as time went on. Prussia was, oddly, a non-contiguous set of dynastic holdings. In other words, the Margraves of Brandenburg, who were also called electors of the Holy Roman Empire, they had many titles, and all those titles just kind of made lands, you know, their own, but they weren't necessarily all in the same place. In other words, many were separated and were enclaves in somebody else's territories, etc. A big chunk of the country came to the Brandenburg state only in 1618, and that actually was Prussia, which had been held by the Teutonic Knights until not too long before then. So, but the last of the heads of the orders of the Teutonic Knights was a cousin of the ruling family of Prussia, the Hohenzollerns, and so they gained that too. But still, by the time we get to the 30 Years' War, Brandenburg, or Brandenburg-Prussia as it was being called, was still just a kind of loose collection of territories here and there and all over the place, spread out across North Germany. And it was flat. this was important in a day when countries looked for mountains and river valleys to protect them from invasions. And one of the characteristics of Prussia was that it was flat, and from the time of the 30 Years' War, all the leaders considered that they needed a bigger army to protect their spread out real estate over the huge North German plain that they occupied. So that's an important part of all this story too. So the 30 Years' War ends. Prussia is now pretty big stuff. It's reconfigured in 1701 when Brandenburg, Prussia, and a king called Frederick, who was Margrave of Brandenburg, Duke of Prussia, head of this and that, other titles, to, as with all these 18th century monarchs, and he was able to get the Prussian duchy to change itself into a kingdom. Now, it just so happened that that holding was not within the Holy Roman Empire. And I know this is kind of confusing to you, but it was confusing to them too, if that's any consolation. In Prussia, this eastern branch of the Hohenzollern holdings, that area had never been in the Holy Roman Empire. And so the Prussians, Frederick started calling himself King in Prussia. That would be König in Preußen. The German word for Prussia is Preußen. And so he was King in Prussia beginning 1701. And so everybody started calling him a king. The Holy Roman Empire was not especially happy that he'd just made himself a king, because they liked to, especially about titles and so forth, the empire was very prickly and made a big thing. But the Hohenzollerns kind of elevated themselves through this sort of trick. The third of these kings in Prussia, instead of kings of Prussia, was Frederick II, and we call him Frederick the Great. He reigned from 1740 to 1786, and he's the person whom Mises discusses most. It's this somewhat morose man down in the corner there, known as a great military genius in his day. As Mises points out, he was he could do a lot more than many other commanders, because he didn't have to ask anybody anything. He didn't have any responsibilities. He was both king and commander of his armies, and he never held a war council and advised vehemently against it. He was a brutal and ruthless commander, and his armies won a lot, not all the time. But he sort of wrote the book for pre-Napoleonic warfare, quite literally. And part of that book, actually, his instruction manual, as Mises points out, was that that basically you shouldn't have very many of your troops from your own country. Your discipline has to be draconian. In Frederick's armies, the most reliable non-commissioned officers, the top sergeants of each battalion, marched behind the line as it marched into battle, and their swords were out and ready. And the purpose of having their swords ready was to kill any soldier who ran. They just wanted to make sure that if a soldier wavered or ran, that the soldier would know that there would be certain death. Whereas if they march forward in the battle, then death is just a potential thing. So it was a highly militarized Prussia that came into the 18th century, and Frederick the Great also improved on that. He improved on military spending. In other words, he had a kind of state bureaucracy that he set up. So all these kinds of things that Mises is discussing in the book, they are promoted by Frederick the Great, who died in 1786. And just after Frederick, about 100 years after Frederick, Prussia reached its territorial zenith. And here's a map of it. If you can, let me see if I can get the, I don't want to get the eraser. I'm going to try and get the pointer. Can you see that? I think everybody can. So if we're looking here at the Baltic Sea in this area and North Sea over here. And this outline is basically Germany as it unified in 1871. There was never a single country called Germany until then. And Prussia remained the state within it. Then you can see that Prussia was still not totally, all one mass of states, but it had pretty much grown together with a few exceptions, Oldenburg up here and Lauenburg over here and a few bits and pieces down here. But North Germany was pretty much synonymous with Prussia by the late 19th century through several different means. So in the Germany that united around Bismarck, and we'll talk about that in a second, in that Germany, Prussia constituted about 3/5 of the territory. So also within Germany were Baden and Württemberg and Bavaria and right there, and a whole bunch of little states in the center here and these states here, and I've mentioned the ones in the north already. So Germany was all those different states, but Prussia was one too. And so basically the Prussia predominated at every level. Bismarck was not only chancellor of the unified Germany in 1871, he was also the prime minister of Prussia. And it's hard to say which role was more important. Here are some pictures of significant Prussian kings. I thought since Mises talked about these folks, you might get a view of them. This is Frederick William IV, who's the romantic autocratic person that Mises describes in some detail. He's he eventually went insane. I mean, just literally insane. And then his brother William or Wilhelm, or man who took the throne as Wilhelm, came to be the king of Prussia. Now we're talking about kings of Prussia now. He's a man who had been in military administration. He's discussed in fairly full detail in the reading. That's the man who would be the founder of the German Empire. In a set of three wars, really engineered by this man, Otto von Bismarck. And Bismarck, the story is told in the reading, so I don't need to recount it. Bismarck came to power in 1862, and by the time we get to 1864, he's able to pick a fight with Denmark, win that war. A couple years later, pick a fight with Austria and have a German civil war, and then 3 years later, pick a fight with the really, really dangerous big power in Western Europe, that is to say France. He defeated France, or the Prussian and German forces defeated France in the Franco-Prussian War, 1870-71, and in January 1871, these two folks, that is William and his servant, his prime minister, Bismarck, basically engineered the declaration of a united Germany, a Germany that was still a federal regime, but united by its princes. So the new state form, Germany, unified for the first time, still had these component states states within it, and the component princes, some pretty powerful and some pretty small. I mean, the Kingdom of Bavaria was a pretty big going concern, Kingdom of Saxony, but the Duchy of Lippe was just a tiny little place, and there were various sizes in between. So they had states, multiple states, and federalism, and that's what they did. This guy is is the actually the son of the grandson of William the First. There was a son who came in between. I mean, William the First had a son named Frederick, who was really the hope of many of the liberals. I'm not sure if he was all that liberal, but he was married to the daughter of Queen Victoria, and there was a great deal of hope. But in fact, he died. Mises mentions him very briefly, only as a sickly prince, and he was sick. He had throat cancer and died after less than a year in office. And so his son, the famous William II or Wilhelm II, that's Kaiser Bill of the Second World War. We're going to hang the Kaiser under the linden tree. That's an old American song from the war, and that's the very Kaiser who was being thought about. So this is the lineup of the Prussian kings: Frederick William the Fourth, then he went crazy, and William, his brother, took over as his regent, and then eventually king. And then Bismarck unifies Germany, and so he's now not only king of Prussia, but also emperor of the German Empire, Kaiser of the German Kaisertum, the German Empire. And then his son dies of throat cancer after reigning for a year, and then this grandson of William I takes over as William II, and he's the last of the Prussian monarchs. He's the one who had to get out of Dodge at the end of World War One, and Germany then became a republic. So that's I think a useful slide. Mises talks a lot. Hey, there's somebody holding a Ralph Rako's book. Well, that's actually me. I'm just like the dictator on a previous page. So here's the thing. There were liberals in Prussia. I'll go back to this slide for a second. There were liberals. You don't see any liberalism represented here, but there were very significant liberal aspects of Prussia and of Germany as a whole. So, and I want to mention at this point that there's a wonderful recent, almost brand new work. It's only a couple months out, if my memory serves, and that is Ralph Rako's great book on all of these things. Everything Mises mentions within a 30 or 40 page section of the book gets elucidated and more in this excellent book by Ralph Rako, one of the great historians of our time and one of the great Misesians, a man who actually studied with Mises in his seminar in New York. So you can snag one of those at the Mises Institute online, or actually go to the Institute and buy it. And maybe after I've given it such a good plug here, maybe Ralph will give me a quarter or something for each copy he sells to you. That is my hope. But I mean, that would be a free market, right? Okay. So anyway, I think I got a liberal. No, I don't have a liberal slide here. I guess I need to go back to, I'll just stay on that one for a second, because I do want to say that the problem of liberalism was that in Germany, the liberals understood the need to control the government. They understood the need to handle the military. They understood, like British liberals did, that an adventurous, aggressive foreign policy was a bad thing that would come back home via, kind of blow back in economic ways and in other ways. They understood all these things, but they were just overpowered. Those Hohenzollerns, these characters were really really clever and potent rulers of the country who managed to make their kingdom attractive in spite of its to many people, in spite of its autocratic tendencies. So the liberals just didn't seem to be able to match it. And in the midst of these wars for unification, here's another point. In the midst of the wars of unification, the liberals fought Bismarck like crazy. They said he's a terrible reactionary aristocrat. He's about as far from a liberal as you can get. He just wanted to be a servant of the king and run roughshod over everybody he could on the way. So they understood that. They fought him tooth and nail. But then Germany won the first war, the one against Denmark in 1864. And the liberals said, well, that was an unfair thing. We shouldn't have been in it. It was wrong. It was a bad thing. And then the newspapers whipped up all the sort of acrid atmosphere of Prussian-Austrian relations in 1865 and 66. And as with modern times, with the press calling for, some kind of accounting for Austria, then those liberals, there was some slippage. Not within the certain individuals. I mean, Ralph Recko's hero is Eugen Richter, and he didn't waver, but so many did. So that once the Austrian war happened, once the Prussians attacked Austria and won and once and for all established domination of Germany in the North German sphere and freedom from evil Austria, which was not that evil, there's just all of this hoopla and flag waving and all of it, and so the liberals caved. What really happened was that the party divided. And some liberals said, no, we're still against the illegal things the government has done, the illegal military moves it's made, the illegal taxes it's raised. We're against all this stuff. But, what can we do? And then the other guys, the national liberals, then just went over to the side of the government and said, well, all those principles are important, like freedom and the financial accountability of the government. These things are all important, but there are certain times, one of them said, a famous one, there are certain times when you just have to pay attention to power. Sounds just like a neocon to me. But in any case, that happened then. And a big part of the group of liberals who had fought hard against the, a kind of autocratic, authoritarian government, just sort of supinely voted to legalize all the illegal measures of Bismarck's government for the last 4 or 5 years. So it was a sad demise. Not quite as total. In Ralph's telling of the story, it's not quite as total a demise. There was a viable liberalism. They kept at that. They kept at it as long as they could. And this is the way history works. I mean, Nobody determines the whole thing. There's a kind of Tolkien-esque quality, I think, to a lot of what human beings have done. And some people carry the ball just as far as they can, and then pass it off to somebody else. And so I think we should give those classical liberals in Germany and in Prussia, in particular, their due. They had a hard fight. And as Mises points out, now we're to this line, as Mises points out, it's a fight against militarism. Militarism is not, and Mises knew this very well, he's part of the discussions of this in the 30s, and he points it out very briefly, but militarism is not military prowess. Militarism is the extent to which the military is able to call the shots within a society, the extent to which the culture of a society is influenced by the military, the extent to which the rulers are surrounded by military people. One analyst of this has said that militarism is everything that's military that doesn't actually contribute in any direct way to military success on the battlefield. Okay, so it's not that you make a cannon and you're a militarist. It's that you parade around in a uniform or demand that people bow down in the streets to the officers or whatever. So that's the militarism that we're speaking about. And Prussia was, for all its good qualities, and Prussia did have many good qualities as a country and a culture, but for all its good qualities, they did bow down to the guys in uniform, especially after the 1871 war. And when Kaiser Wilhelm II came to power in 1890, 19 years after unification, he surrounded himself with military people. Well, his grandfather had too. And so there's a true militarization of this society where the military could decide, didn't have to report to anybody. Mises mentions a famous incident in Alsace-Lorraine, which Germany had taken in the after the Franco-Prussian War, and you know, some recruits down there were ridiculed and beaten and whatnot. And when there was an inquiry into it, the military just said, "Well, it's not your affair. It's not the affair of the civilians. We decide what happens here." And this, I have to say, you see, there are many parallels in this history to histories that we have unfortunately known in our own day. So all this should sound just slightly familiar to us, at least in my opinion, but it certainly sounds familiar to me. In any case, there is this problem of militarism, and this leads to other problems as well. It's not the only problem, but it certainly contributes to what Mises calls étatism and this overweening, overwhelming power of the state in Germany. Okay, we come to the section on nationalism, the part two of the omnipotent government, and there are several elements. I want to make sure I run through them because it's not just about nationalism, because there is the whole definition of étatism in there. We need to talk a little bit about liberalism, what Mises meant by democracy, and then we need to spend some time on nationalism and also the economic nationalism of autarky. So let's plunge in there. Étatism, as I said at the beginning, is a term of that comes to us from Mises, which is one of his less successful coinages of terms. So a number of ways that Mises talked and spoke have been adopted by many of us and have made their way into society to a great extent. But étatism is a term that didn't quite make it, at least not yet. It comes from the French word l'état, and that of course means state. So you may be familiar with the absolutist king Louis XIV, who said l'état c'est moi, the state she is me, or whatever. And that expression probably, and that's the same état. What Mises wanted, as he explains, what he wanted to emphasize was the French and continental core of socialism in all forms and interventionism. That is to say, he wants to show us that the main activity here, the main push for étatism, comes from some of those guys we talked about last time. In other words, Auguste Comte, Saint-Simon, his mentor. It comes through Marx too, but it comes to Marx after he had Saint-Simonian funneled through him, and numerous other French and other continental theorists contribute. And so in this way, Mises wants to say, well, it's not just about a it's not just the statism, it's a broader term, l'état, or étatism. And so he kind of universalizes that way. What does he mean by, here's another one of my word clouds, hope you like it, and this is for this next section, the section that, called étatism and nationalism. And what he means by étatism is either socialism or interventionism. In other words, it's any doctrine of economics and society which puts into the leading, which puts the state in charge, which involves a state-directed economy, and it, whether it's just interventionary or whether it's totalitarian or anything. So étatism for Mises is this greater classification, and then sub-classifications of interventionist economies and totalitarian economies. Mises, another one of his great lines from the book. I think I'm going to put it up on my quotes page on my website. Étatism is the occupation. Oops, I should have put occupational disease of rulers, warriors, and civil servants. Governments become liberal only when forced to by the citizens. So, étatism is Mises sees it as a disease, and it's, I think, from this writing and other writings come many of the insights among Austrian scholars into the extent to which there is a kind of, I would almost say, structural tendency on the part of the rent-seeking elements of society to push for statism. And then this has swirled out into the culture, so that there's by this time, as everybody knows, a huge cultural bias. People who don't know anything about the theory of the state or the theory of welfare or the theory of liberalism or any of it, or the theory of the market, they have strong opinions that the government should look into, should stop you from drinking raw milk, or that the government should protect you from whatever. So there's an occupational disease at the heart of this, and then there's this spread of it to society. But that's a separate problem. Étatism is for Mises something that destroys civilization. For him, liberalism is anything, is the doctrine that represents the individualist side in the collectivist versus individualist battle. He sees then étatism as having sort of won out in the second part of the 19th century. I want to say a word or two about the state and anarchism, because this undoubtedly, I mean, based on some questions that we had last time, or a question that we had last time, and also on general discussions among Mises students and scholars, and that is the subject of the state and anarchism. And so again, there's Omnipotent Government, Part 2, Section 2, that gives you the location. Mises says here that the state is an apparatus of compulsion and coercion. The state is violence. It's not about whatever else it does, and it does do other things. It gives milk to the little children in school. It doesn't give it. It takes tax money and then hands the milk over to school systems. There are all these things that the state does, but the core of it, says Mises, is that violence. It's that coercion. It's that compulsion. You know, just as a person who's now getting to be you know, in the older part of life. I'm 57. I was 57 2 weeks ago, and so. You know, I've lived through a few things in my time, and I've got to say that in this decade, this section by Mises about the violence of the state and the compulsion of the state, it really reads differently than it did 20 years ago. We just have a mounting sense, I think, among most of us, that the state is more and more the kind of Leviathan monster that Hobbes talked about and that Hobbes wanted it to be. More and more around us, this what Marx might call naked power makes its appearance, so that the state is not so interested anymore in sugarcoating it. You go on YouTube and you see the policeman throwing kids into jail for blowing bubbles at them and beating them up along the way and all these different things. And so you really do get a sense these days that this whole chapter rings really true. Now, having said that, I can also say that Mises continues. Well, the state's a necessary institution. In fact, he says it properly, correctly run, it should be the foundation, can be the foundation of society, but only if it's administered correctly, and that is if it protects the rights. Because for Mises, then, society is something separate from the state, and society is the real thing. The state is the created abstract apparatus that takes control of the violence. And so the motor of society is that voluntary exchange of goods. It's the actual action of people carrying out their will, doing what they want to at that moment in time. And so there's this other great brilliant line of Mises that I think of very often that has stuck with me from reading to reading. The market is a democracy in which every penny gives a right to vote, and where voting is repeated every day. Just a side note on that term democracy. There's been quite a discussion of this, especially since within the Austrian movement, Hans Hermann Hoppe has, along with others, so prominently discussed the failures of democracy. I mean, and many other camps have too. I mean, it's clear that within our movement today, democracy is considered in effect a means of sort of voting everybody else's money into your own pocket by indirect means. But I think Mises meant this, and I'll give you a couple of links here in a second, which show that Hoppe agrees with this and some other Austrians, leading Austrians. Mises used this term in a very specific way. Again, this is a time-conditioned writing, and when he said democracy, what he meant was a political system that, 20 years ago people would have called it pluralistic. In other words, it's a political system where there's a parliament, where people have representative institutions, where there are tight strings on the government purse that are only controlled by representatives of the people. There's a constitution in effect, and so the law is a contract, all these kinds of things. So that's what he meant by democracy. It's a very limited kind of republic that he's thinking about. This is the context of what he says. The goal of liberalism, he says, is the peaceful cooperation of all men. And this is a really important part of this whole scenario, that for Mises, the goal is the important thing. Here's another aside, and it's an aside I meant to put here, so I'm not wandering off the topic, just so you'll know. But liberalism in the 19th century, classical liberalism, was not, a revolutionary movement. It was a radical movement in that the theorists of that movement went to the root of the problem and said the root of the problem is that property is not respected. The root of the problem is that people don't have liberty. So there's a radical solution. But it was not a revolutionary solution in which the liberals necessarily wanted to go out in the streets and loot and pick up paving stones and throw them and that type of thing. Those some just occasionally they did. Liberals in the 19th century found ways to cooperate with many kinds of governments. In other words, liberals were not people who would live in a monarchy and just go around all the time talking about how to overthrow the monarch because the monarch had some kind of theoretical power. In the 19th century, when almost all European monarchs were constitutional monarchs, liberals went around saying, well, the Constitution limits the monarch. Let's work on the important thing, freedom. The system itself, the type of system, didn't matter very much to the liberals as long as the level of government was low. I'll say that again. The system really didn't matter to those liberals as long as the level of government remained at low, as long as there was a kind of small state, a state that just policed society, a kind of Lockean state. So that's an important part of this whole thing. And also I note that at the end of this discussion of the state and anarchism and the goals of liberalism for peaceful cooperation, at the end of that, Mises throws in that important section on his the source for this, which he considers to be a utilitarian analysis of the whole thing, as opposed to some kind of natural rights analysis. And for those of us who have been Austrians for very long, then we know that there's two different analyses of these questions within the Austrian movement, both the Misesian kind of natural rights, the Misesian kind of utilitarian argument, and the Rothbardian natural rights one. And I just point out that this is a place where Mises talks about this explicitly. Here's a couple of notes on Mises and anarchism. If you want to read some good analyses of this, there was an interview quite a few years ago of Hans Hermann Hoppe on this. It's on the Mises website, very well worth reading. And also, there's a commentary which includes a kind of folding in of both some things that Murray Rothbard said, and then Stefan Kinsella's commentary on Stefan's website. So take a look at those if you want to, and you can see what we're talking about. I mean, essentially, what these Austrians say about Mises and anarchism is that he really wasn't quite an anarchist, but he was pretty close to being. That he thought that the fact that there were people in society who couldn't make decisions for themselves, who were unable to, and because their children or demented or whatever, that because of this, because the problem of crime, that you do need some kind of minimal state. But on the other hand, he was in favor of secession, and that secession, you know, when pressed, Mises sort of brought it down to the level, as Rothbard tells us, of the village. And so there's not far to go there. When Mises was talking about anarchism, and we discussed this a little bit last week, when he was talking about anarchism, he was talking really about the left-wing part of anarchism and directing most of his arguments in that direction. So anyway, I just point that out as a way of making sure we get all the nuances here. Note on interventionism and monopoly. I think the most important insight here, and I don't think we need to beat it over the head today, but it's a very excellent one, and that is basically that monopoly is not the outcome of unfettered capitalism, as it is frequently claimed to be. On the contrary, It's the result of government policies aiming at a reform of the market economy, that is to say, an interventionist economy. And this is true in so many ways, and there's so many aspects that this has been explored, but we do find that as a part of his argument in Omnipotent Government. Here's another piece of the story, Adolf Wagner, who comes up in the last bits of the this discussion of ecotism. And Wagner's an important figure, so I thought I'd put a picture of his mug in this slideshow. Wagner was one of those Katheder Sozialisten, the socialist of the chair, as Mises called him, and that was totally pejorative. Make no mistake, this was all totally pejorative. He didn't like them at all. These characters had taken over the chairs, the professorial chairs of the German universities, and plumped their kind of big government sort of social policy, socialist politics policy for all those years. They were protectionist to the max. They were all about empire when they could get it. They had a kind of religious gloss that went through their discussions that also hooked into sort of duping many of the churches into helping promote imperialism. And so there's a whole history here of these Katheder Sozialisten, the socialist of the chair. And Wagner is one of the real founders, maybe the real founder of the school of national economy, as you see up at the top. And he helped found the Verein für Sozialpolitik 1873. And these were, for Mises, his great nemesis, these people who had promoted socialism from their chairs. Now, we're nearly to nationalism, which takes up a long section in the last part of the book, and I'm a little slow here, but we'll have plenty of time for question and answer, so I'll let you look at my word cloud here a little bit while I say something about nationalism. Mises was writing at a time when almost nobody analyzed nationalism in a scientific way. And I really have to tell you that this analysis from the 1940s holds up very well in all kinds of discussions even today, although not many of the historians or political scientists who analyze nationalism today hearken back to it. But frankly, it's taken some scholars 60 or 70 years to get to the point where Mises was back in the war. The things to remember about classical, what I'm going to call, this is my term, classical nationalism, and by that I mean European nationalism in the 19th century. Nationalism is one of these terms that's changeable, like democracy or conservatism or whatever. And so I want to say that Mises was talking about what I would consider classical nationalism in the 19th century. And then when we get to the 20th century, it's a kind of neo-nationalism or something. Just very quickly, European nationalism, it's useful to point out that the term national comes from the Latin word natio, which means birth. So it's about the relationships among people who are born into a certain relationship. Nationalism has to do with a kind of mysterious brotherhood that binds people related by their birth. In other words, it has to do with the assertion that Poles should want to live with Poles in a single country, that Magyars or Hungarians should want to live with other Hungarians, Magyars in a country, that Croats should want to live with Croats, etc., etc. So this is a kind of mysterious, there's no real reason that this should happen. And there are resorts here to cultural arguments and then some Darwinian arguments and other arguments, but whatever the bonding is, it's a little bit mysterious, it's a little bit unexplained. And so these lead to the classical nationalist goal of make your nation your state and your state your nation. This is just a restatement of what Mises says in the book. Just a shorthand way to remember it. The real nationalists of the 19th century had the idea of making their nation their state and their state their nation. And in almost no case did a national group start up like that. Either it was like Germany and Italy, which was a nation divided into many states, or it was a case like Hungary, which was a nation that wanted to secede from the Austro-Hungarian Empire and make its own state. So both integrative and disintegrative elements in that goal of making your nation your state. What Mises points out in a very elegant discussion is that nationalism is really a creative approach to the problem, how to mobilize the masses in support of the collective good. In other words, how governments, how bureaucrats can mobilize people and keep them going. This whole Comtean problem of how to keep the masses all in their traces so that they don't rise up. So some of our, these are some of the issues. I'm tongue-tied here. I think I've talked too long. These are some of the issues that Mises discusses in terms of the nationalists. And he mentions many of the classical nationalist thinkers in his book. Just FYI, if you want to look up some nationalist writings, you can look these up online anytime. Fichte, the famous bombastic German, talking about how Germans ought to rise up and prove their relatedness. A very elegant very moving nationalist, Giuseppe Mazzini, who was the grandfather of Italian independence, and Lajos or Louis Kossuth, who was the great Hungarian nationalist. And then, of course, Theodor Herzl, in writing the first Zionist writings in the at the end of the 19th century, is a Zionist nationalist, and it's part of exactly the same movement and the whole this whole way of thinking. So I just throw those in. And then, of course, there's the Gilbert and Sullivan version of all this. I'm trying to figure out why that says Hunt Tooley there now. But in any case, these are the ideas that were being lampooned in the 1878 opera HMS Pinafore, and I think probably everybody knows it, but if you put it in this context, it really is hilarious. He is an Englishman, for he himself has said it. You know this tune, don't you? For he himself has said it. I'll stop now. And it's greatly to his credit that he is an Englishman, And then the boat sailors say, for he might have been a Russian, a French or a Turk or a Prussian, or perhaps Italian. But in spite of all temptations to belong to other nations, he remains an Englishman. He remains an Englishman. So this is what they were lampooning at that time, and it's a very funny opera. If you haven't heard it, in fact, practically everything Gilbert and Sullivan did. I mean, these are two great. They don't go by the name of classical liberals, but I would consider them part of the good guys in history. Another one of the good guys mentioned by Mises here, who says, you know, it's sort of a last gasp of liberalism that the French late liberal, Ernest Renan, complicated person, but he did write this essay, What is a Nation, Qu'est-ce qu'une Nation, in 1882, at a time when the hyper, almost biological nationalism, this aggressive nationalism, was welling up, and he wrote this beautiful essay. It's really a wonderful piece of writing. You can find it easily online, but just to quote a little of it, let me sum up, gentlemen. Man is a slave neither of his race nor his language, nor of his religion, nor of the course of rivers, nor of the direction taken by mountain chains. A large aggregate of men, healthy in mind and warm of heart, creates the kind of moral conscience which we call a nation. So long as this moral consciousness gives proof of its strength by the sacrifices which demand the abdication of the individual to the advantage of the community, it is legitimate and has the right to exist. So, I mean, he's not totally in agreement, but his version of a kind of patriotism is a different sort of thing, and Mises looks on this approvingly, as he said, the last gasp of liberalism. So I think that's the last slide. We come to my last of the word clouds, and it's the last bit of the text that I've thrown into there. So you get nationalism and doctrines and myth and people and men and life and masses. So I don't know if that can tell us anything, but I feel like I know more looking at that word cloud. And I thought I would put it there so that we can just leave something more or less interesting while we begin do the question and answer. And I think we have plenty of time. Let's say we'll go for the next 40 minutes and see if anybody's still with us. And if everybody's done by then, we'll stop then. If not, we'll go a little bit longer. So. Questions and answers, s'il vous plaît. Or just questions. If you've got answers too, put those up. Okay. Let's see. I'm looking up at the previous comments, see if there's any question in there that I didn't. Oh, Lee, good question. Bismarck's empire was, I didn't see this before because I had it flipped over on the other side. Bismarck's empire was considered the First Reich. It's actually, Lee, it's actually the Second Reich. Reich is a term that they also applied to the Holy Roman Empire, this sort of Charlemagne empire. So that was the first one, the one that started, technically speaking, in 962, but really on Christmas Day 800, and went all the way to 186. That's the first. Then the second is the Reich of Kaiser Bill and World War One, and then that Reich fell with the end of the war, and Germany became the Weimar, truncated, a smaller Germany, became the Weimar Republic, and then Hitler said that he would build a third one. Reich, by the way, does not, I see this as a persistently mistranslated word. Reich, R-E-I-C-H, means, it has to do with, it's a cognate of our word to reach. And so if you're, some of you probably know this, you probably know German, maybe you do, maybe you don't. There may be some German speakers among you, but If you're at dinner with the and you're speaking German, you say, "Pass me the salt." You say, "Reichen Sie mir bitte den Salz." So it's about reach, and so Reich is more related to our word realm than it is to the Latin word imperium or empire. You see, so in a way, that whole German sense of realm is a little bit different. Now, by the time Hitler gets it, it's very aggressive and expansive. But previously, when they talked about the German realm, you know, they didn't necessarily mean a big banging empire that's going to go out and conquer a lot of people. And indeed, I'll tell you this: the terminology, even after the Germans lost World War One, it was a German Revolution. They overthrew the king, Kaiser and King. He left. Went to the Netherlands, and so the Republic took over. At first it was socialists, and then it was a mix, and then it was more or less sort of the middle-of-the-road parties that ran the country. But here's the thing. They never got rid of the term Reich throughout all the administration. So during the even the most revolutionary days of the Weimar Republic, a lot of those socialists, the left wing, still called it the Reich. So it didn't exactly mean, it didn't exactly have those imperial or monarchical connotations that we sometimes think. That's in a way neither here nor there, but I'll give that to you for free. Okay, let's see, Lee says, I picked up the Harp's Positivist Republic, and can you explain the difference between positivism and empiricism? Well, it's I may not be able to do that. I mean, I don't have that discussion before me, so I'm not really sure in what sense. I mean, I know the difference between positivism and empiricism. I would just simply say that positivism has to do with this whole system of Auguste Comte, which in a way is a kind of metaphysical system. You have to kind of believe that there is this positivist goal, and you work toward that. And that was part of his civic religion, too. But you kind of believe in the goal, and so it's more metaphysical, whereas empiricism is more about just taking it by the case, and we run society by case by case, and the parliament is, well, it's there, and so let them make the decision for this case or that case. Lee, I think that would be it, but again, I don't know that I'm that I can do that justice without actually reading what Gillis has to say. So, would Otto the First be considered the first emperor of the Holy Roman Empire? From Cam Ray, if I'm saying your name correctly. Otto the First, well, I would consider Charlemagne the first emperor, but if you look in some accounts, they say, oh no, well, that was just the Roman Empire, not yet the Holy Roman Empire. But on the other hand, they called it the Holy Roman Empire because the Pope crowned Charlemagne and thereafter had at least a hand in crowning all the rest of them. So I would say it's Charlemagne, but maybe some, I'm not a medieval historian. I'll let them argue over that. You could make arguments for this one or that one or the other one being the first totally Holy Roman Emperor. And they really didn't use the term on a regular basis as a kind of official designation until much later, really in the 1300s or 1400s. So, yeah, it's hard to say. It's one of these historical answers that you got to waffle on a little bit because it's just not that clear. Many scholars have compared Prussia to ancient Sparta. Is this a fruitful comparison? You know, I think so. But here's the thing about Prussia. Let me just say this about Mises and Prussia. The thing is, Mises was a real partisan of Austria, and anybody who knows much about these two states has to have some feelings about one or the other. I mean, those of us who are historians of the German world, you know, we have allegiances, and people who live there have allegiances, and so forth. And Mises lived in the easygoing Austrian Empire in Galicia, on the edge of it, one of the peripheries of it. It was not quite a laissez-faire society, but, you know, it was pretty close. It was much more open to different peoples than anywhere else in Europe. Certainly much more open than Prussia, where the Prussians did have different nationalities in their country and were trying to push them away. The Austrians were trying to bring them into the state. It's just like the title of nobility that came to Mises' family. I mean, this wouldn't have happened to a Jewish family in Germany at all. But so he had a lot of allegiance to the Austrians, and he only talks about the really bad stuff of in the Prussian world, except for the Prussian liberals. But I'll say this: there are many good things about the Prussians. The Prussians, it was part of the Prussian culture to work hard. It was part of the Prussian culture to say, here's a problem, let's start at the beginning and fix it, and not stop until we get to the end of it. It was a Prussian kind of cultural element to say, well, we find ourselves in a bad situation, we're not going to whine about it, we're just going to get busy and work. And so a lot of these things that we think of as a part of German culture, the work ethic and the attention to detail and these kinds of things were very, very strong in a particular way in Prussia. And culturally, it was an enormously powerful educational system and everything else. So, you know, when we critique Prussia, it was not all the soldiers, but that's the state itself is what made the problem. And so Mises emphasizes this. But it is a really interesting kind of question. At the level of the state, then there is some sense of this kind of Spartan existence. I mean, I think the Kaiser probably thought he was living in a little Sparta there. But on the other hand, I don't think that this really filtered very far down into society. And I do think that there is, for all as being overwhelmed by the masses, there's a lot going on that has to do with laissez-faire, with the rule of law, and with things that we would all have thought in Prussian history. There's an old story, for example, that for all Frederick the Great's high and mightiness, that when he tried to tear down a mill that marred his view from his house, his palace, Sanssouci, that the miller met him on the road and waggled his finger in his face and said, Your Majesty, you know, there's some things that we have here in Prussia that are over the king, and one of them is law. And so there's this, whether this happened or not, it was a Prussian story that everybody told. So there's that. There's people taking initiative in all kinds of ways. You know, there's Charles Tilly wrote a book about the Prussian economy in the 19th century, and it's a totally free, laissez-faire economy. The Prussians, before these wars in the 60s, there's a real tradition of Prussian laissez-faire in economic matters, especially currency matters. That's very, very interesting. I'm not going to give three cheers for the Prussians, or even two, but I'll give them one cheer. And I don't think they, even if the leaders envision themselves to be something like Spartans, I don't think that really percolated down to the people very much. Let's see. David Gordon, is that David Gordon? So David said that positivism is committed to an empirical theory of knowledge, but the empiricist need not be positivist. Well, I will certainly bow to his answer to that. Thank you, sir. Okay, Leekate, what do you think about, what do you think brought about Prussian militarism? Did they have a lot of enemies around them? Yes, well, I mean, that's this is one of the points that I made just briefly as we swept through this, Lee. Partly Prussian militarism is a function of the flatness of the place. I know that sounds a little bit flat-footed, but it is really true, and it's not totally flat. I mean, I'm from Texas, and I really know what flat looks like, and Prussia does not all look like that. But it's flat enough so that there's no mountain range, there's no river valley, there's nothing that can keep an army out. And so in this world, this tricky world, beginning with the Holy Roman Empire civil wars surrounding the Reformation, and those began actually, the hostilities began in the 1530s, 1540s, brief truce in 1555, then they were back at it in the early 1600s from in one place or another, and then the general war broke out in 1618, and the German world was engulfed in the 30 Years' War, which probably depopulated it by a third, maybe by a half. So, yes, armies were crisscrossing everywhere. The Brandenburg became a battlefield. Then the Swedes intervened, and they crossed the Hohenzollern territory. It was all the monarch could do to keep it together. And one of his responses, I mean, I'm saying this in a general way, that they were flat to be invaded, but certainly one of Frederick William's, is an earlier Frederick William, the great elector. That's a tricky thing. The Hohenzollerns really like Frederick William or Frederick William, and that's confusing. But Frederick William, the great elector, who lived until 1688, you know, it's just that it's amazing that he held them together. He did it by a big army. And his predecessor said, well, if a big army is good, then a bigger army is better. And so that's how that kind of came about. I hope that answers your question. Let's see. Laura says, Mises spoke of the philosophical underpinnings of what he calls etatism as being an external ideology that German intellectuals and upper classes took up and implemented. Were there any homegrown German etatists at first, or was the entire implementation a synthesis of outside Western thought? I think there were some, and I mean, in a way, I've got to say that Hegel, who really became, I mean, if we just want to limit this to the 19th century, I think Mises is totally correct that Schiller and Goethe and for goodness sake, Beethoven, where, I mean, all these people were essentially in their feelings and their thinking, they were essentially liberals in the 19th century. They were certainly for what Mises called the peaceful exchange and the peaceful relations among all men. And so that was, I think, the norm for the German thinking classes. But there are certainly people who go against it. And from the time of the French Revolution, Hegel and others are really enunciating a kind of etatist position. Well, I've mentioned, I've given the reference to Johann Fichte, F-I-C-H-T-E, who through his early nationalism is enunciating already in nationalist theory a kind of etatist view. Because nationalism, after all, is just collectivism with a different, slightly different basis from other varieties of collectivism. So it's nationalism that comes in Fichte, but he is an etatist too. Hegel, you could say that. So yeah, there were some homegrown people, but the extent to which they were all also channeling European thought, we could talk about that for a long time. But the Germans helped themselves. They're very inventive, and once they got the idea, they really ran with it. And when we get to those socialists of the chair at the end of the century, they're tremendously potent in kind of restructuring German thought in sort of socialist ways. Yeah, it's a good question, really good question. From Leslie Webb to all participants, could you give the name of the author again? For the book on the Prussian economy in the 19th century, yes, Charles Tilly. That's T-I-L-L-Y, T-I-L-L-Y. And I cannot remember the name of that book. It's something like Prussian Currency Policies in the Rhineland. It's been a while since I've read it, but if you can't find it, email me and I will I'll find it for you. What have we got next? Cam Rate, all participants, says, I would add that the Prussian military was aggressive with a great understanding of tactical maneuverability, masters of taking the opportunity when the enemy center of gravity had been diagnosed. Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, it's here's the thing. The Prussians were thorough. I mean, and in these military affairs, they were extremely thorough. Here's another interesting thing, and I bet this is related to what Cam is is referring to, and I bet he is thinking this too, that in the Prussian army, oddly, in the course of the 19th century, the Prussian army structured itself so that decision-making actually went farther down the chain, so that by the time you get to World War I, say, a person who is even a corporal already has some command aspects attached to the rank. Not that they were all commanding on the battlefield, but there really is that that part of it too. And that's in the German army now, by the time we get to World War I, but it's very much a German army that had been taken over by the Prussian army. There were a few of the imperial states in the German Empire that maintained their own armies, the Saxons and the Bavarians, etc. But the main German army was essentially the Prussian army expanded to the rest of Germany. Oh, I see. David, if you're still here, best greetings and thanks for the answer there. Matthew Tomko says, and David, just chime right in if you like. That's perfectly fine. Would you say that that Mises' interpretation of the forces events leading to the world wars jive with revisionist views along the lines of someone like H.A.B. Taylor, or would you say that there are some points of contention between them, such as Taylor not emphasizing collectivism like Mises does? Well, there are differences in those interpretations, and you mentioned Taylor in particular, and I don't think that he had much interest in economics and domestic policy and so forth. His book is basically a kind of diplomatic history, and in that sense, it's very good, and there are some pretty effective arguments. But I think that Mises and then the revisionism that kind of comes out of the Austrian movement later on, that's a part of it. I think one of the outstanding parts and pieces of it is that they tend to connect domestic policy with foreign policy in a kind of seamless way. Now, some historians these days say they do that, but it's only fairly recently, whereas the Austrians were doing that quite a while ago in extremely meaningful ways. And so you've got these greats like Charles Callan Tanzel and others who really knew how to weave that diplomatic story and the relations of nations together with the domestic policy of people and what was essentially motoring the whole thing. So I think that's a big difference. That would certainly be a difference between many of the revisionists and Taylor. Right. I like Taylor's book. I mean, it's fun to read. He's got many, many great insights. But I think there's some difference there. Let's see. From Danny, was the Reformation and its effects on the Holy Roman Empire an example of decentralization actually leading to stronger states and less individual freedom? I think that's probably so. In other words, I think that's exactly right, because the nature of the beast. What was happening, as you say, is that the states, all of them, Brandenburg, especially all the Protestant states, but it had a kind of effect on the Catholic states too. That's important. In those places where, for example, the Duke of Saxony suddenly has his own church and is more or less acting, he doesn't, like Henry VIII, say, well, I'm head of the church now when he takes it over, but he's more or less acting like that. And so when he does that, he's more powerful rather than less. So it's true. I mean, everybody becomes a little Hammurabi, so to speak. You know, they all They all get their own law code. It's all enforced by God and all of that. So yeah, I think that's a pretty good way to see it. And it's an odd kind of situation, because we want to think about secession as always kind of working in, you know, in favor of liberty. But in these cases, there was a bit of secession going on that didn't necessarily lead to it. And by the same token, this is an interesting piece of German history. It's actually, if you want to look to kind of homegrown liberalism and homegrown tendency to say, well, toward individualism in Germany, it's really in Southwest Germany. It's really in Baden and Württemberg, which were known as bastions of liberalism within Germany. I mean, Bismarck hated that part of the country, and he hated all these South German liberals. And of course, they were all, or most of them, were Catholics. So that's an interesting thing. And you know, in the end, that's where Stauffenberg came from. The guy who tried to kill Hitler, he was a South German, from a South German family, who originally thought Hitler was really the bomb, but in the end, well, that's a pretty good analogy. They thought he was the bomb originally, and then they ended up putting a bomb under the table to kill him. So anyway, you know, I got a million of these jokes. If I could just let them out, you know. So anyway, that's an interesting, a very interesting question. From Lee, what are your feelings about Nietzsche while he talked about individuality and its importance, and his hatred towards socialism? It seems as though he expressed the desire to have Superman run the world. Well, it's a little bit far afield in this setting. I mean, I'm with you. I think there's a kind of conflict in Nietzsche. I would not, you know, there's that bitter end kind of individualist, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, create your own identity and your own lifestyle and your own set of priorities and all those things, and then crush the other people. I mean, it seems like there's a tension. Although, to tell you the truth, Nietzsche is often, I think, a little Rorschach test-like, in that my friends who have disputes over him seem to see what they want to see in him, so it's a little bit hard to tell. I think there are some of those passages that are not totally transparent in Nietzsche, and I think that's enough for me to say about that, because if we get off on Nietzsche, then I really am on the... I mean, historians should just stay with history. I believe that's the case. I'm kind of joking here. Okay? Leslie has a question in the Q&A panel. You know, I haven't even had that open. Okay. Leslie Webb asks, how was Germany able to become such a strong economic power in the late 19th century? Oh, what a good question. Excellent question. Prussia became the strongest North German and eventually the strongest German state, partly through luck, all right? Part of it was hard work and that Prussian ethic, and part of it was just blind luck. At the end of the 30 Years' War, the Prussians found a little bitty place close to the Rhine River, a tributary of the Rhine River, and it was next to some territory they already happened to have inherited on the Rhine, a place called Jülich-Kleve, okay? And they inherited this little river valley and the territory around it, and didn't give it that much thought. Well, that little river valley was the Ruhr, and so when they—that's R-U-H-R. So scroll forward from 1648, and then you get the Industrial Revolution, and you get the Ruhr being the richest coal producing and steel producing, adjacent to a steel producing area in Europe. And so the Ruhr Valley becomes the industrial heartland, the Detroit, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, all rolled into one set of cities there, very similar. And that's where the Krupps lived in Essen in the Ruhr Valley and built their weapons and so forth. So in a way, it's just dumb luck that that they got a piece of territory that had all this coal sitting under it. Now, actually, then the Frederick the Great, who was very interested in coal and very interested in what was beginning to appear to him to be an industrial revolution. It was very, very early. Remember, he died in 1786, so this is a very early part of it. But he did understand that coal was extremely important. And it so happens that in his first war against the Austrians in 1740, he took a part of a German region called Silesia away from the Austrians. And that Silesia became just behind the Ruhr in coal production in the late 19th century. So in these two ways, Germany got these resources, but there are plenty of resources in Germany that the Germans could have worked with. Potash is an extremely important product. The agriculture is doable in many ways. There's a huge economic base. And then I add to that of all the countries on the continent, and I include France also and Belgium, Prussia was the most liberal, small l, in terms of the economy, as I mentioned before. So in a way, this explains it. And so the industrial cities that grew up on the Ruhr, the German resources, and then this wide open economy up until the 1870s. It's really only after 73 and the coming of that Great Depression that Mises mentions, that there's sort of it's a Higgsian moment where there's a crisis and the government clamps down, and it's right in 1873 that Otto Wagner forms this Verein für Sozialpolitik, the Institute for Social Policy, and so that's all happening at once. But up to there, it was a very liberal country, and at that point, they had these powerhouse industries, and indeed, you can go on and on and talk about the German dye industry that was the basis for the whole world's industrial chemistry, and on and on. And so by the end of the century, all of the technical schools in Germany were more or less more advanced than any of the technical schools anywhere else. So it becomes a huge economic powerhouse. That is true indeed, and it's in those various ways. It's a good question. Excellent question. I'll say this now. I like that Stauffenberg movie, Danny. That's a very good movie. I've done a little bit of work on the German resistance in my research, and I had the privilege of meeting some of the relatives of the people depicted in that movie among the conspirators. So it was a proud moment for me, and if you take a picture of Tom Cruise and take a picture of Stauffenberg, they're pretty close to looking exactly alike. And I'll say this about that. I heard people criticize that movie because it appeared to be an action movie, but to me, the action was, if anything, subdued from the real events. It was about as close a depiction of some kind of literal, actual happenings as I can think of that I've ever seen in a movie. So I was extremely pleased with it, and I thought they did a great job. So in many ways, I'm not the greatest fan of Tom Cruise movies, though I like them fine, but I thought that one was excellent. Yes, that's true. Danny says, also, didn't the German states liberalize their economies after the Napoleonic Wars. It depends on which. Some did, some didn't. everybody had before them the great example of Austria, and Austria-Hungary ran a fairly liberal regime. They had a similar situation. They had a Kaiser that believed he was a divine rights ruler from 1848 on, and all of them did. And he was, you know, this super rich, distant kind of person. But on the other hand, he believed that, you know, that rulers should work for their countries. And so the Kaiser of Austria, you know, had audiences every day where anybody who got on the schedule could come in and talk to him and so forth. And then in the economy at large, there was quite a bit of freedom. So there's that example. Now, Austria, of course, was excluded from the German Empire, but it's part of the German world. So everybody's looking at them. Baden and Württemberg, once again, had a fairly liberal economic policy. I think they wanted to. Imitate open economies. There were some little states who tended to be more, I don't know, kind of more statist, more ecotist in that period, who tried to continue their mercantilist sorts of policies. Especially states that were existing, that kind of existed because they charged tolls and charged customs for going through their areas and sort of made their money from an older version of speed traps, I guess. But yeah, there was a lot of economic liberalism in Germany. But once again, the Prussians pretty much wrote the book on it, and it seems to have been a case where it may have been neglect, total neglect. I think that's the impression, if I'm remembering. It's been a long time since I've read that Tilly book, but he seems to say, you know, this appears to be neglect, and he's not especially in favor of it either. But it appears to have been neglect on the part of the government, which is good. I mean, that's the thing. If they don't do anything, well, if they're so corrupt they never get together and, you know, go to Congress and have the meeting, then, you know, we're all a little safer, I think. So yeah, that's what I would say. Salutary neglect. A perfect yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, and I think this happened in France in the time of Louis the 15th. I mean, I think he was just so occupied with his sweet young things at the court that you know, he just didn't get out much, and his many ministers and Madame Pompadour, they were always pushing him to do things, but he just didn't want to do them. He was just busy, and so not a lot got done. And this is one real argument about the French economy. I mean, before the French Revolution, it's, you know, kind of runs on its own for a while. It wasn't in quite as bad a shape as our cartoon version of the French Revolution tends to say. So it was in pretty good shape. Yeah, Louis XV certainly thought it was good to be the king, that's for sure. Yeah. Are there more questions? You asked some excellent questions today. I hope I've helped with my answers, helped a little bit in that way. So, are we out of steam? Let's see, chat. Okay, thank you. You're very welcome, Laura, and thanks so much. I guess we're about at quitting time, and I think people are beginning to leave. So I will bid you all a good Sunday evening or whatever day it is, wherever you are. I'm not sure where you all are. I'll look it up, but. Thanks so much to all of you for coming, and I enjoyed it, and I will see you next week, okay? Thanks. Goodbye. And Danny, I will sign out now.